Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Hello everybody, Richard Martin, along with the last of our messages to you about the good standing of the American economy before the long holiday, starting on Friday at 5 p.m. I guess, and running through to Tuesday. There will be no wake-up call on Monday because of the holiday. I doubt that I will be at the beach. I live less than 30 seconds from the beach, but when you have it, you know, you don't miss it, whatever the expression is. Anyway, for those of you who may have not been listening for a few days, we are, in fact, back on our line with the caller facility. So, as always, if you should wish to make a call and to express your opinions or ask questions, please feel free to do so by calling 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. Now, since the line has been back, I haven't received any questions over the air, which I find perplexing, the more so that we have a mountain of mail to deal with today, which has arrived by email. So if you do try to get through and you fail to get through to me, I would be grateful if you would email me, because until I get some calls, I cannot be sure that the line is actually working okay, although I am assured that it is. But I would be grateful if you try to get through and you don't succeed, please email and let me know so that I can alert the engineer accordingly. All right. Well, the latest piece of absurd nonsense from Congress, you probably heard about it. On Tuesday, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved legislation allowing the Justice Department to sue OPEC, no less, for limiting oil supplies and working together to set crude prices. But fortunately, the White House threatened to veto the measure. It's probably one of the few things that George Bush has done with which I approve. So we'll see what happens. But they have an overwhelming majority, so I guess they will be able to override his veto. The bill would subject OPEC oil producers, including Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Venezuela, to the same antitrust laws that U.S. companies must follow. The measure passed in a 324-84 vote, a big enough margin to obviously, as I said, to override a veto. The legislation also creates a Justice Department task force to aggressively investigate gasoline price gouging and energy market manipulation. Representative Steve Kagan of Wisconsin, who sponsored the legislation, had this to say. This bill guarantees that oil prices will reflect supply and demand economic rules instead of wildly speculative and perhaps illegal activities. End of quote. He also said that Americans are at the mercy of OPEC for how much they pay for gasoline, which this week hit a record average of $3.79 a gallon. The White House opposes the bill, saying that targeting OPEC investment in the United States as a source for damage awards, quote, would likely spur retaliatory action against American interests in those countries and lead to a reduction of oil available to U.S. refiners. So as I said, Bush was correct in threatening to veto House legislation, and this veto is clear-cut as well. ironically, it seems that after having nothing good to say about this man for nearly 8 years, I am sort of defending him in his issue. It feels kind of strange, but the arrogance of Congress is astonishing. I mean, Congress actually thinks it can pass legislation the rest of the world must follow. You know, imagine the outrage if China passed laws and told the U.S. what to do. Well, in my opinion, China, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, Iran, and 5 dozen other countries should all issue a joint statement, and this is how it should read. If you are wondering why oil prices are high, you should look into a mirror. You are blowing trillions of dollars in Iraq, wasting countless billions on housing bailout plans. You have troops stationed all over the world, wasting energy at great expense. The taxes you are collecting do not meet your expenses on anything. Look at your latest farm bill, your tariffs on ethanol, and your policies on grains, all of which are driving up prices. It's no wonder the US dollar is falling. Your president and treasury pay lip service to a strong dollar policy, but the actions of Congress and your administration are doing everything they can to destroy the dollar. Instead of trying to write laws for the rest of the world, please take care of your own business. Well, instead everyone sort of tap dances around the issue, attempting to be as diplomatic as possible. Clearly diplomacy is not working, and it's no wonder that diplomacy is failing, given that Congress is practically brain dead. A nice, well-deserved go-to-hell message just might wake Congress up. I doubt it, actually, but hey, sure can't hurt. So I guess this is what really needs to be done, ladies and gentlemen. Let's look at it, okay? First of all, eliminate the ethanol subsidies. Now, I've talked about this before. Brazil produces ethanol at one-third of the cost of America, but America will not allow ethanol imports. Eliminate crop subsidies. In fact, eliminate all tariffs and all subsidies. Adopt a balanced budget, which, by the way, will strengthen the U.S. dollar dramatically. Get out of Iraq, Europe, Japan, and nearly everywhere else. This will ease geopolitical tensions and have Iraq pumping oil within 4 to 5 years or less. End U.S. imperialism, which, by the way, is very dollar-supportive. Legalize hemp for fiber production and biofuels, which will reduce the need for petroleum-based fibers, and hemp will be far better at producing biofuels than corn. Let the free market find a solution. If Congress would just get out of the way, the free market would find a practical solution. Yeah. Instead, Congress wants to sue OPEC. In a way, suing OPEC is innocuous because it is a pointless waste of time and going nowhere. Well, it's very frustrating, frankly, because the answers actually are so easy to come by. You know, the plan has to start with free market principles. You know, U.S. imperialism and Congress attempting to dictate laws for the rest of the world just won't work. All right. Some housekeeping here. First of all, on Monday, we are closed. It is Memorial Day, and we shall not be around. As I have already expressed, we will not have a show on Monday, although I suppose that they might play a show from the past. My name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call. If you want to call into the show, as I said, please do so. Please feel free to avail yourselves of our 800 number, our toll-free number, which is as follows, 888-873-4643. Now, repeat that once more. You please call the number. Eric, the engineer, will take the call. He will put you on hold, and then I will be informed, and I will pick up your call as soon as possible thereafter. Once more, the number, 888-873-4643. If instead you prefer to follow the crowd and email your questions, you are more than welcome to do that as well. The email address is as follows. And please do not worry about the case. Lower or uppercase, it matters not a jot. So here goes. R. Martin, at gscorporation.com. Once more, and the G stands for global, S for strategic, and that's where I work, global strategic investments. The word corporation needs to be written out in full. So once again, the email address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. Okay, and if you'd like to call me privately, that is also an excellent solution, and you should do so by picking up the phone and calling my direct line at 305-357-5575. Once more, 305-357-5575. Okay, just a word about the mail. We have a lot of mail today. Many of you are sending me articles to read. Now, this is the proverbial throwing of a red flag in front of a bull, because I love to read, and unfortunately, I am sucked into your articles. I find them all very illuminating, and I don't have time to read them. So I have to try to construct 25 hours out of 24, and I've noticed that it cannot be done. Therefore, to alleviate my problem, ladies and gentlemen, I would be grateful if you have an article that you want to send to me, if you could please précis it, if you could give me a rough summary in two or three sentences of the article and what it is you would like me to discuss, I will do so. If you send me the article, I will, of course, read it, and then I won't have time to take a shower before I come to work in the morning, and so I will upset my co-workers accordingly, and nobody will benefit except my brain, which probably isn't the best way to go, and so I would be grateful if you could possibly keep your articles to a minimum and just allow me to know the important ingredients therein. Thank you very much, and on we go. Let us have a look to see what we have here today. We have... well, let me look here. We have several letters in the mail. Let's just go through them in no particular order. The first one comes from Celia McGee, who says, "Dear Richard, I've attached an article from the Wall Street Journal, and time permitting, I'd like to know what you make of it. Recently, I heard you say on the radio that you expect housing prices to fall by 80 to 90% from peak to trough. Do you think that this will be the case everywhere? I know you respect Nouriel Roubini, who has quite a reputation for pessimism, and yet he has been quite consistent in predicting a drop between 20 and 30%. I understand that things are bad and getting worse, and I can certainly see housing in some areas falling by as much as 90%, but I really wonder if you think that's possible across the board, and if so, why?" I do have a copy of the article, but I'm actually going to just basically answer your question, Celia. When I mentioned the house prices falling from 80 to 90 from peak to trough, obviously I didn't mean every house, you know, that was ever built. There are differences nationwide in degree, clearly. What I thought and hoped that I might have made clear, although maybe I did not, was that I expect that housing prices will fall by the amount that we talked about, by some 80%, in the most speculative areas, areas which have gone through the roof over the last few years, from the peak, which is probably midsummer 2005. To the trough, and I don't expect to see that before 2012. So what I think you need to understand, however, is that even in areas where there wasn't that much price appreciation, many people took out home equity loans. And by taking out these loans, they made themselves very vulnerable in the sense that if they can't pay off the loans because they have these subprime mortgages, their properties will have to be sold, and that itself will push the price down rather dramatically which of course affects the rest of the area in which the houses are to be found. So you'll see a certain amount of price depreciation which is put into the market from exterior sources, as it were, exterior motivations, mostly concerned with people taking loans they couldn't afford. So please bear that in mind, that it isn't necessarily just a question of, you know, an appreciated area being driven down by desperate sellers. There are other inputs to consider as well. Okay. Just in on the email from Steve Kruger, who I will talk about later on as well, it says, Richard, our Congress acts like every member save one has eaten the paint off their cribs in their youth, and we are to suffer for it today. Absolutely, Steve. Words of wisdom, as always. No quibble there. We have an email from Susan, who says as follows. Richard, what do you think of this? I've heard you speak about puts before in a positive way. This guy is saying pretty much the same thing as you are about the state of the economy. Best, Susan. Susan then pastes in an article written apparently from Michael Schulman, which is one of many I get in terms of an advertisement. And Susan, I'm glad you sent me this, because a lot of you will be getting through your spam mail ads for people trying to sell you put options. That's to say, options to sell stocks at a certain price by a certain date. And this, of course, can be very lucrative, because the premiums can be very small, and then when the market falls, the premiums rise, and then, of course, you make the difference between the price that you paid and the price that you get eventually if those premiums do, in fact, expand, and they can expand by several 100% in some cases. My attitude is stay away from the options market. Now, I am very bearish on the stock market, as you know. I think the market will fall very substantially in the next few years, but I will not buy put options, options for sale, for the sale of stock at given prices, because all is a matter of timing. And the problem with options is that not only do you have to get the market direction correct, but you have to get the timing of that direction correct. And that is extremely difficult. And the trouble is that many people will make a lot of money in the first two operations that they do, the different sets of puts that they buy, maybe a couple of times. They make a lot of money, and then they think that they have become, they've unlocked the secrets of the market, and they become experts, and then they lose all the money back in the next operation or the next two or three. So I strongly recommend, Susan and anybody else, that if you get these huge advertisements with massive letters on the front, or numbers explaining how wonderful they are, you ignore them. Just ignore them. Because when you see the lists of the successes that they've had, and in Susan's case, it's on the second page, 176% gains in 5 weeks, 184% gains in 7 weeks, 106% gains in 3 months, 152% gains in 11 weeks. All these sound very good, and they look very good on paper. What they don't tell you, of course, is the losses that they have suffered. And they always leave those out. I think it shouldn't be allowed. I think that when they give these kinds of track records, they should be obliged to date them and include all of the operations that they did. So by all means, sell short in the stock market, but don't buy options. The leverage is too great, the timing is too uncertain, and you have a very high probability, in my opinion, of losing your money. Right. Steve, I come to your next email, in fact, your email that you sent me earlier this morning at 12:47 p.m., Steve Kruger, and this is what Steve has to say. Richard, Yesterday, we went shopping at a huge mall in Egg Harbor, New Jersey, in Macy's. We were on all three floors, and I counted 14 shoppers total at 11 a.m. The price of gas is preventing a lot of hardcore shoppers from their appointed rounds. We also went into three clothing stores in the same mall, and there was not one shopper. This was very spooky. You can park right in front of any store you want to. When we gas up our car, I never see one pay cash. It's all charge cards. To me, when you charge gasoline and you have a charge balance of over $9,000, you might not pay for today's gas until 4 years from now, if at all. We wonder why and when the stock will tank. I do think it will be the price of oil that will do the stock market in. Richard, do you think that oil will be the axe man that does the market in? Thank you, Steve Kruger. Two things, Steve. Oil and interest rates. Now, in fact, what people don't know is that, or realize rather, is that interest rates did in the market in 1987, and they did it in again in 2000. What seems to happen is that as the stock market goes up, as it has been, people sell their bonds thinking that stodgy old bonds, you know, 3 or 4% is nothing in comparison with the stock market, which is going up in leaps and bounds. So you get this phenomenon where people sell bonds, and as you know, ladies and gentlemen, when bonds go down in price, interest rates automatically go up because interest rates are a direct function of the bond price itself. So if the bond prices fall, it means that the interest rate on the bonds currently being traded must go up. Therefore, this could be, you know, the last nail in the coffin. When businesses find that they simply can't borrow, not that there is any money for them to borrow anyway, but even when there is, if interest rates are so high that they, given the lack of consumers today and the difficulty in doing business, if it is the case now that it costs them even more money and consumers have to pay more for their mortgages and basically everything just costs more, the operators in the stock market will, of course, come to the realization that they made a terrible mistake and the market will crash. I think the market will crash. I think it will crash very, very soon. I hope all of you listening are out of your stocks. I've mentioned this on many occasions. Get out of your stocks. Stay away from the stock market and stand by, you know, while the storm hits. So oil, yes, of course oil will have a major impact, much more than ever before. So the answer to your question is absolutely it will. Yes, oil will be the axe man that does the market in, along with interest rates. We all have heard the stories of people, you know, unable to practically to go to work because it's at $4 a gallon. It just isn't, it's not economical actually even to operate one's car. So it's a very serious situation, this oil situation, very serious indeed. And I've discussed it a couple of times. I'll have more to say about it, of course. But I do nevertheless want you to see oil as a speculative bubble that will collapse. It's already down quite sharply today in the markets, the price of oil. It's down $2.50 as we speak from last night's close. So I do think it's very possible that we've seen the top in oil. If we haven't, and it goes a little higher, I think the top is imminent. We will see the top very, very soon. Prices will come down, way, way down, and people will forget that there was ever a problem, and life will go on. The peak oil is just another of these scaremongering tactics that people use. All these questions about how, you know, speculators have been responsible for the oil, the oil price rise. I think it's just, again, scaremongering. I think basically when oil comes down, the speculators will either sell short and make money on the downside, which is what they do, as much as buy oil when it goes up, they will sell it short when it goes down. You can never eliminate speculators. They provide liquidity. They don't always, they're not always responsible for price moves in markets. And when they are, this is just a function, a temporary function, they can't, and neither do they want to levitate markets indefinitely. If the markets go down, they're just as happy because they can sell short. If you didn't have speculators, you would simply have large-scale operators going out and buying the physical product. They would just go out and buy barrels and barrels of oil. This is what Iran is doing, actually, right now. They're holding tankers full of oil and not selling it, in the hopes that the price will go up. And, of course, this has pushed up freight costs, which I believe comes in another of my pieces of mail here. And I'm just wondering if I had it here. I've got a lot of mail to go through, so I will actually see if I can't find it right now. There we go. Thank you for your question, Steve. Next question comes from Hugh Thomas, who says, dear Mr. Martin, with the huge problems arriving and brewing with the economy resulting from the behavior of professionals in the finance industry, why haven't we heard media commentaries citing the fact that these same professionals would have handled the privatization of the Social Security, probably one of the grandest attempts at revisions of government policy in the last 50 years? There's no lack of chilling tales of known perverts released to predate yet again, but no commentary to my knowledge on the possible consequence of this fortunately euthanized policy initiative. Am I just out of the loop, Hugh Thomas? I think that there isn't any more. They've given up on that absurd, as you rightly point out, Hugh. Privatizing Social Security is throwing gasoline on the fire. People would very simply, if they had their Social Security privatized, they would gamble it all away, and they'd have no money, and then they'd have to come back cap in hand at a ripe old age for the government to bail them out again, just as they've had to do in the housing market. So just on that level alone, bailing out impoverished retirees because they've spent all their money would not be a good idea. Unfortunately, what's happening is that an enormous number of people are cashing in on their 401k plans and their IRAs and spending that money just on basic needs. This is going to push retirees into unthinkable penury in the years to come. This is one of the worst problems that society will have to face, and very few people are talking about it, by the way. Social Security, of course, prevents them doing that because, they basically have to pay in, and hopefully they will get paid out. But in one way or another, the last thing that should be done with Social Security, for all kinds of reasons, by the way, not just the tendency of people to spend their money prematurely, the last thing that should be done is to make that money available to them in advance. Okay, thank you, Hugh. Then I have Louis Varoud, who says, Richard, I know your position on peak oil, that there is plenty of oil for the indefinite future, but can you comment on this article and video? Well, then I get an article. I'm not going to read the article, but I will just mention the highlighted areas, which I think is important. There was a gentleman called Robert Hirsch, a Management Information Services Senior Energy Advisor, giving a dire warning about the potential future of gas prices on CNBC's May the 20th Squawk Box. He said, we're going to be hitting $12 and $15 a gallon, and then we're going to be talking about rationing. All nonsense as far as I'm concerned. How does he get to 12 to 15 from 4? Why not 22 to 30 or 241 to $256.73? I mean, when these people give these figures, I always become suspicious because 9 times out of 10, these emotive figures come in order to allow the people uttering them to become famous or to gain some kind of publicity. And I don't know who Robert Hirsch is. Unfortunately, I'll probably not forget his name now because somebody told me that he'd be the one predicting $12 to $15 a gallon. He's done what he intended to do. He's got his name onto the map. There's another guy, there's somebody called Charles Maxwell, who's the senior energy analyst at Whedon & Company, says, and I quote, he expects an oil-induced financial crisis to start somewhere in the 2010 to 2015 time frame. Well, why not now? Why do we have to wait 2 years for the financial oil-induced financial crisis? See, they never tell you these things. So long as they can create a soundbite without any explanation, which of course can be argued with, which is why they don't give the explanation, because they know that it can probably be shot down. So it's just much more impressive to intone these kind of scary words. This guy is a regular CNBC contributor, apparently, and the vice president of risk management for MF Global. This is another person called John Kilduff, who said on May the 7th that he expects gas prices to drop following the Chinese Olympics as China's economic boom slows down. Well, I think that's much more likely, Lewis, and so I would tend to concentrate on what he has to say, although it's not nearly as exciting as what the other two, Hirsch and Maxwell, have to say. They're the ones that, you know, you'll be talking about at cocktail parties for the next 3 weeks, I expect. Every time that there is a bubble in any market, you're always going to have these pundits coming out of the woodwork and saying crazy things, like Harry Dent was saying in 2000. He wrote a book called Dow at 36,000, when the Dow was trading at 11,700. He decided that he could sell a book by saying that Dow was going to 30,000. Somebody else, whose name I've forgotten, which isn't very helpful, should have remembered the name, of course, and that was the idea of the guy who said that the Dow was now going to go to 100,000, but I'm afraid that my brain didn't catch the name, so the policy didn't quite work. I didn't recollect the important part about the message, which was the man's name. So anyway, there you have your answer, Lewis. I hope it is satisfactory. Stephen writes and says, dear Richard, I just discovered your show and I love it. I appreciate your knowledge and guidance and was hoping you could give me some counsel. I'm 64 years old, work as a construction supervisor in New York City, and I have no retirement savings. However, I own a home in upstate New York with 20 acres that was assessed for close to $1 million several years ago. My plan was to sell the home with 10 acres and keep 10 acres for myself and build a small retirement home with the money. I'm anticipating that the new home with services will cost me approximately $300,000 to build, and that the remaining profits from the house will be about $700,000. I know nothing about investing and financing and have no idea where the best place would be for this money if things go as planned. I would love you to comment about my plan and what you would do in a similar fashion. Thanks, Stephen. Well, Stephen, you are obviously new to this game, so I would say, take your $700,000 and either buy CDs or preferably buy treasury bills and wait for this bond market to collapse, which it is now apparently trying to do as I look at my screen here. And then when bonds are at much more depressed prices, buy treasury bonds over about a 10-15 year period, and you'll have a very, very nice income, which is the interest rate on those bonds for many, many years. So that would be my immediate advice. Obviously, if you want more specific advice, you will have to call me because a lot depends on other elements of your financial situation as well. But in the main, I read this letter out loud as opposed to answering it individually, because I think people should understand that overall, in a general sense, when you have money today, you must keep it liquid as you possibly can, and then when the time comes, you buy bonds. There are other ways of making money in a more aggressive context, but those I don't discuss here because they really depend on each person's individual circumstances. So you just get the generic version here. Andy Celsius writes to me saying, listening to Nassim Taleb's lecture on the Long Now Foundation website, he suggested putting the maximum amount into 0% risk investments and a small amount in high-risk investments, if you care to speculate. You've established CDs and treasuries as 0% risk. What would you consider worthy small high-risk investments as an example, not necessarily investment recommendations. The quick generic answer to that would be short ETFs, exchange-traded funds which play the market on the short side. But they're very. It's very important to know what kind of ETFs to buy according to what's going on in the market at any given moment. So I don't want to be more specific than that. But again, if anybody needs advice about that, call me and I will do my best to point you in the right direction. But he's absolutely right. Taleb is absolutely correct. You know, 0% risk investments is the place to be today for totally secure money. And as I just mentioned to the previous email writer, Treasury bills is the way to go. All right. Then we get Margot Froehlich. Hi, Margot. It's been a while. Who writes, hello, Richard. Yesterday I had a meeting with the vice president of HSBC. Her home is now on the market, and I commented that we had sold our home 2 years ago in anticipation of the real estate downturn. Her comment was, how could you know that? I work for a large bank, and I didn't know. Very interesting. On another note, today I happened to look at the current chart for the Baltic Tri Shipping Index, and it appears to be heading in an upward direction, whereas in January it plunged. Could you comment on the current statistics and the implications for the economy? I'm on the road during your show today and will listen this evening. Thanks again for all you do. Most sincerely, Margot Froehlich. Margot, welcome home. I have actually just mentioned what I think is the ultimate reason for why shipping rates are soaring right now, namely that certainly Iran and maybe other oil-producing countries are withholding tankers with oil in them. Of course, they're paying, you know, the rental and everything, but it's more they perceive it as being more profitable for them to fill the oil tankers up with oil and then just hold on to them until they feel the price has topped out, and then they will release them onto the market. And I think that's what you're seeing, and I think that's why shipping rates are soaring, because people are withholding tankers from the market. It's certainly not because of increased commerce and trade, which would be the obvious answer as to why shipping prices are rising so vertiginously. So that is not the case. So I don't think a lot of people are, in fact, drawing entirely the wrong conclusion from this, which is a shame. But anyway. Thank you for the question, and I'm glad to have been able to stress that, which I said that I would do earlier, but I couldn't find your letter, Margot. Then I get a letter from Bill Adamo, I apologize, I don't know how to pronounce your last name, A-D-A-M-O. Mr. Martin, do you believe this advice to still keep 401ks in stocks? Answer, no. I don't. As I've said many, many times, and I know you listen to my shows, Bill, because you've had I've had emails from you before, and I actually think that you called in a couple of times. So I'm sure you know the answer in advance. No, get your money out of stocks. Get them out of mutual funds. Get into treasury-only money market funds. Still having a lot of problems with those. I'm getting a lot of mail about this, and it frustrates me as it must you too. You get these supercilious kind of arrogant administrators telling you, you know, that their wretched little fund is as good as anything else, which of course it is not. I just like to slay these people. I don't know what else I can say. I will gladly talk to any administrator. If you want to give me their number, explain the problem, I'll call them myself. You know, I like to think I can hold my own with those people, but of course, most of you aren't that knowledgeable in these things, so it's difficult for you to argue. But you need to get a Treasury money market fund installed into your 401k menus, ladies and gentlemen. This must be done, and you have to insist. So please do your best, and as I say, follow it up with a letter, with return receipt, and I have dictated it, and you will find it, I think, on the February 11th archive. Also, I get a letter from Frank Devlin. saying, Richard, I'm not sure if you read this newsletter. Basically, the newsletter is Gerald Celente's newsletter, which I do read, he says, I thought you'd find it interesting. Could this be Plan B when Helicopter Ben runs out of bullets, a sure way to gain all sorts of controls very quickly, and the street will figure a way that this insanity is good for the market? Gerald Celente has a pretty good record at predicting trends. Your comments on the resilient U.S. consumer were right on the point. Just yesterday, I suffered through a talking head on Bloomberg gushing over the amazing resilience of the U.S. consumer. Going broke is now a synonym for resilience. Pollute the language and take control of the debate. My most difficult task is sorting through the obfuscation and propaganda, synonyms for lies, from the political financial complex. If lies were money, we would truly be the richest nation on earth. All the more reason we need wake-up call. Keep it up. Regards, Frank. Frank, thank you very much. Appreciate the email. I think it's useful and interesting to discuss why Americans are broke when they retire. What exactly is going on here? Why is it that the overwhelming majority of Americans, when they come to the retirement age, have no money? Well, I think there are two main causes of this. Firstly, most people don't save enough money. A survey in 1997 by Public Agenda, which is a nonpartisan opinion research organization based in New York, found that 76% of the respondents believed that they should be saving more money for retirement. Among those who said they believed they should be seriously saving for retirement, only 6% said that they were ahead of where they should be in their plans, while 55% said they were behind where they ought to be. And the other reason why most Americans are broke when they retire is because people's financial habits are counterproductive. And here's one example. One-third of participants in 401k programs are currently borrowing against their retirement savings. This debt is often described as benign because the required interest payments are made to yourself. But in fact, these loans carry very high risks. If the borrower changes jobs or is laid off for any reason, stops participating in the 401k plan, the full balance of the loan is due immediately. Any part of the loan that is not paid off is treated by the IRS as a withdrawal, subject to taxes and, except for employees who are 59 and a half or older, a 10% penalty for early withdrawal. And I don't think the majority of 401k borrowers understand this risk. And the other element of this counterproductive nature of people's financial habits is that the average credit card debt per household is now $8,000. The average interest rate on this debt is 16%. Typical credit card agreements require 2% of the balance to be paid each month, or $20, whichever is the less. Even if a household stopped making any new charges, paying off an $8,000 balance by making the minimum payments while incurring interest of 16% would take more than 31 years. And in the process, that household would pay total interest of $14,104. You know, it is ultimately why most people are nearly broke when they retire. The median U.S. household retires with liquid wealth of $15,000 and a net worth of $130,000. And most of that net worth is in home equity and vehicles. You know, all this is very sobering to anyone, you know, dedicated to helping other people help themselves. Why does this happen on such a large scale among a population that's one of the best educated and most privileged in the world? Well, there's a Harvard University professor called Dr. Leibson who believes, and it's very interesting, he believes that Americans are irrational as a people, that they only have weak self-control and are unrealistically and bountifully optimistic. Well, I think there's a fourth factor at work. I think too many Americans are passive and just don't want to be bothered. Leibson says that mainstream economists assume incorrectly that American consumers are rational beings. You can hear this assumption often in newscasts that attempt to explain economic behavior of all sorts. sort of like, in response to the deteriorating demand for labor, Americans tightened their belts and deferred purchases of durable goods. Well, this sounds wonderful in theory, but do you know anybody who decides whether to buy a new washing machine on the basis of economic statistics? On the other hand, behavioral economists, and by the way, Leibson counts himself among them, believe that consumers have a lot to learn. And he cited a study by the U.S. Department of Education that found among a group of men and women 21 to 25 that only 40% could calculate the change due to a customer after a purchase of two items. Only 20% could accurately read and interpret a bus schedule. Well, how many of these young people do you suppose can read and understand the Wall Street Journal? Obviously, most young people don't have a lot of incentive to learn to make change and figure out bus schedules. But even when the stakes are high, most people don't seem to have a lot of motivation. Less than a third of Americans who are over 26 years old and haven't yet retired have tried to figure out how much savings they will need in order to live comfortably in retirement. But what about the people who do invest regularly? Now, this is quite interesting, I think. Surely they must be more sophisticated about finances, you would think. Well, Leibson and other researchers wanted to test that notion, and they figured that an excellent way to do so is to monitor how people manage their 401k investments. Most of these accounts, as you know, give employees a range of choices so they can allocate their money between stocks, bonds, and cash, or the equivalent. Investment advisors and financial columnists pay a lot of attention to how 401k money should be invested. But the research suggests a lot of employees don't care very much. Leibson described a study in which employees were told how, on average, their fellow 401k participants had allocated their assets. Most of the workers in the study said they thought the average allocation of other workers was better than their own. Other research indicates many employees believe all plan options are of equal value. If a plan has three stock funds and one bond fund, participants' average allocations are typically 75% in equities. If a plan has only one stock fund and three bond funds, average allocations are typically only 25% in equities. Well, this is not what I would call the behavior of savvy investors. A survey of retirement plan participants by John Hancock found a startling level of ignorance. Nearly half, 47%, believe that money market funds are made up partly of stocks. About the same number, 49%, thought money market funds are made up partly of bonds. Only 9% knew the truth, that money market funds contain only short-term fixed income securities. That survey also found that only one of every four participants understood the inverse relationship between interest rates and bond prices, that when interest rates rise, bonds lose value, and vice versa. That is very important information for any bond investor to know, especially these days. You know, I'm certain that after a few months of rising interest rates and falling bond prices, I'll start hearing from people who have no clue about what has happened to the bond funds they thought were so safe, which is why I keep telling you to keep your money liquid in short-term treasury bills, because bond prices are going to fall, in my opinion, and then will be the time to buy the bonds when the interest rates correspondingly are much higher. That will mean that you will lock in high interest rates with your bond purchases and thereby receive a monthly or a six-monthly income, which will be very nice indeed. Thank you very much. Okay. Leibson cited research about taxable accounts as well. He said a typical investor with taxable assets loses 3 percentage points of return each year in tax payments and unnecessary costs. 2% to taxes, and load fund investors, of course, will pay a lot more for the privilege of owning funds. Mainstream economists believe that consumers make careful plans and carry them out. You know, this assumption is very convenient in an ivory tower, as it gives academics an easy tool to explain behavior. If consumers do a certain thing, that must mean they were planning to do it. But Leibson thinks that's a myth. Many consumers make plans, but they aren't at all diligent about carrying them out. Instead, they give in to temptation. Lifeson says Americans are so eager for instant gratification that over and over again they shortchange themselves. He cited a simple question that researchers often ask subjects during meetings, classes, and workshops. Which would you prefer, a 15-minute break today or a 30-minute break tomorrow? Time after time, 15 minutes today is perceived as more valuable than 30 minutes tomorrow. Here's an interesting variation. Which would you prefer, a 15-minute break 100 days from now or a 30-minute break 101 days from now? In this case, people seem very willing to wait another day in order to get a longer break. You may have had the same immediate reaction yourself. But in fact, the choice in these two questions is exactly the same, a 15-minute break 1 day or a 30-minute break 1 day later. There was an unusually philosophical conversation that was overheard between two teenage girls on a subway train in New York City. Girl A: would you rather be beautiful now, knowing that you would gradually get ugly later in life, or would you rather be ugly now and know that you'd be more beautiful later? Girl B: that's easy. I'd be beautiful now. You know, we make long-term plans and undermine them with our short-term actions. For the long term, we intend to be patient and delay our gratification. We'll quit smoking, start exercising, lose weight. Financial planners advise their clients to save early and save often. Baby boomers say they want to save 15% of their incomes. But real life seems to get in the way. The actual median savings rate is 5%. The average smoker has tried to quit 4 times. The typical employee procrastinates about 2 years before enrolling in a 401k plan after it is offered or after the employee becomes eligible. In a survey of 100 workers in a large company, 68 said they were saving too little money. Of those 68, 24 said they planned to increase their savings rate within 3 months. After 3 months, only 3 of the 68 actually did so. Two professors found that the average cost of a one-month membership to a health club was $75. On average, members visited their clubs 4 times a month, meaning they were willing to pay $19 a visit. The same clubs, on average, charge $10 per session for pay-per-visit memberships. Americans hold about 10 million Christmas Club accounts at banks, thrift institutions, and credit unions. These accounts pay no interest, but they are popular because they build savings through automatic deposits from checking accounts and even from interest-paying savings accounts. Similarly, the majority of U.S. taxpayers get IRS refunds every year through excess withholding from their paychecks. Workers like this forced savings because the money is automatically taken from their pay before it can be spent. Garrison Keillor says, "In Lake Wobegon, we believe in salting money away not only as an investment but also to remove it as a temptation. In that respect, consumers' beliefs appear to reflect reality. But many behavioral economists, including Lifeson, believe that consumers wear rose-colored glasses. We tend to be so optimistic that we fool ourselves. When asked to compare themselves with their peers, research subjects almost always report a self-enhancing bias that reminds one of Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average. Relative to their peers, research subjects reported that in comparison to the general population, they were more intelligent, more likely to succeed at work, more likely to enjoy their job, and more likely to have good marriages. These researchers must love their jobs since they get to meet such outstanding people. The list goes on, with subjects reporting that compared to others, they are more likely to own homes that appreciate, more likely to live beyond age 80, and more likely to make money in the stock market. In one study, 70% of the subjects reported that they were safer drivers than most of the population. What Lifeson calls unbounded optimism leads to unrealistic expectations. In 1998, the average investor expected the stock market to grow 20% a year for the next decade. A common attitude among young people is, my financial situation will improve in the future, so I don't need to start saving now. I'll do it later. Another case study done by Leitchman and three other researchers makes me wonder how many workers even care about their 401k savings. The study tracked the behavior of employees in two companies that switched their 401k sign-up procedures. In the first company, before the change, new employees could choose to sign up for the program by checking a box on a form. If they didn't check the box, they didn't participate. Only about 30% of the employees in the company signed up. Then this company made a change. Now, every employee that was not in the plan was given a choice to stay out of it. But unless they actively chose against participation, they were automatically signed up. After the change, about 90% of the employees were in the plan. The great majority of employees in this company took the easiest course, not checking a box. Whether that resulted in not participating before the change or in participating after the change. Whatever was easiest, that's what most of them did. After the change, the workers who were new to the plan could specify what percentage of their pay was saved and how it was allocated among various investment choices. But if they didn't check other boxes on the form, they were given the default arrangement of 2% contribution, all of it going into a money market fund. About two-thirds of the new participants chose the default allocation, a money market fund, a pretty poor choice for most people in a 401k plan, when things were going well. The second company in this study, before it made the change, also allowed new employees to sign up for the plan, and those who didn't sign up were excluded. In other words, the default choice was not to participate. Only about 30% of the employees had checked the box and were in the plan. Then the company changed its form, and all of the new employees had to check one box or another to participate or not. There was no default option. After this change, participation grew to 50%. Another study of a 401k behavior was reported that I found equally instructive. The state of Nebraska did a study of its 38-year-old 401k system in action and pronounced it a failure largely because of the choices made by employees. Nebraska was an innovative employer. In 1964, it started letting workers choose between staying with the state's traditional defined benefit pension plan or joining a new self-directed 401k. The state required all workers to contribute part of their pay either to the pension plan, which guaranteed retirement benefits based on salaries and length of service, or to the 401k, which guaranteed retirees that they could direct their own courses and take their accumulated investments at retirement, while, of course, they received no pension. Nebraska didn't merely leave 401k participants to their own devices, as most corporate 401k plans do today. The state let participants take time off from work to attend day-long educational investment seminars, something that few employers do today. 2 years ago, the state studied its 401k system, one of the oldest in the country, and found that over the past 30 years, the typical participant had an average annual return of 6% to 7%. That compared with about 11% annual returns that the state's traditional pension fund managers achieved in the same time frame. The bulk of Nebraska's 401k participants did not allocate their investments successfully. Nebraska offered 11 fund choices, but 90% of the contributions wound up in only three funds, and half of all 401k money was in the default option, a low-paying guaranteed investment contract fund. State officials began to fear that they were wasting taxpayer dollars by giving matching contributions. The result, existing employees can stay in the 401k plan, but after next January, new Nebraska employees will no longer have the 401k plan as choice. Whether or not other employers follow suit, Nebraska's experience is very sobering, especially since it spans a long time period, and especially since the state went far out of its way to help employers learn to do the right things. The lesson seems to be that the majority of employees didn't care enough to be bothered. Unfortunately, Nebraska's experience reinforces some of the findings reported at the Harvard conference by Leitzen. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish you all a very, very nice, relaxing, and happy long weekend, and I will be with you again in exactly 1 week's time, Thursday at 2 p.m. Take care. See you then.